Imagine waking up tomorrow morning. You know, you reach for your smartphone and there's just zero bars.
Yeah, the ultimate modern nightmare.
Right. No Wi-Fi, no 5G. You look out the window, everything seems totally normal, but the internet cables have been severed. Or maybe a state firewall has just suddenly like slammed shut.
Which is happening more and more.
Exactly. So how would you actually find out what is happening in the world? Today, you, our listener, have sent us a stack of sources that proposes a wild, honestly audacious backup plan.
It really is. The documents you send in are fascinating.
Yeah, you brought us excerpts from William Pohl's blog, I think it's called, An Evolving History of the World, along with this highly tactical engineering white paper.
Unpacking something called Project OmniReach.
Or NewScape, depending on which slide you're looking at. So, welcome to the deep dive. We are unpacking this subversive blueprint designed to basically bypass big tech, bypass state censors, and deliver uncensorable info to 3 billion people all at once.
3 billion. Just staggering scale. And I mean, the premise running through these documents challenges everything we kind of assume about modern communication.
Totally.
The white paper defines the core issue we are facing today as the gatekeeper vulnerability.
The gatekeeper vulnerability.
Right. Yeah, the argument is that legacy news distribution and really the entire digital media landscape is incredibly fragile, specifically because of how it gets from point A to point B.
Because it goes through so many bottlenecks, right?
Exactly. Whether you are reading an article or streaming a video, that data is routed through a maze of corporate and state-controlled servers.
I really like how the slides frame this, actually. The way I visualize it from reading your sources is that right now, digital news is essentially a tenant living on borrowed infrastructure.
Oh, that's a great way to put it.
Like you are renting a house, but the landlord, and that landlord could be a massive app store, a search algorithm, some local telecom monopoly, or a government censor. They can just change the locks on you.
Just at any second, yeah,
Right.
without warning.
Right. You don't actually own the path to your audience.
And that rented existence is the absolute crux of the problem. If you rely on cloud hosts or payment processors or, you know, content delivery networks, you are subject to algorithmic throttling or just outright deplatforming.
Any single entity in that chain can pull the plug.
Right. So the alternative proposed in these engineering blueprints is what they call the sovereign pipe.
Sovereign pipes sounds very sci-fi.
It does. But the underlying insight is that true media independence requires owning the distribution channel from end to end, just entirely outside the jurisdiction of local cell towers or ISPs.
Okay, my immediate thought when I was reading that is if streaming and mobile data are fundamentally vulnerable, what exactly is a sovereign pipe? Like, what does this backup plan actually look like in the physical world?
Well,
Are we talking about laying new secret submarine cables or something?
actually, no. The proposal goes in the complete opposite direction. It looks up. Yeah. The blueprint for Project OmniReach starts with something it calls Layer One, which are these global master hubs. We are looking at incredibly high-power shortwave radio transmitters.
Oh, wow. Radio.
Yeah, but massive ones.
Yeah.
The documents specify 250 kilowatt transmitters placed in highly strategic, really remote locations. The primary example they use is the Chagos Islands, specifically Diego Garcia.
Wait, Diego Garcia. That's right in the dead center of the Indian Ocean.
Exactly.
Let's talk about the physics of that for a second, because the math on that location is just wild. The slides feature this massive map, and by positioning a tower in the middle of the ocean, you get this unencumbered, clear shot to the global south.
A huge footprint, yeah.
But hold on, if I am trying to reach someone in a landlocked country, like thousands of miles away, how does a single radio tower in the ocean actually reach another continent? Don't mountains or, you know, the curve of the earth get in the way?
Right, so that would be true for a standard FM radio or a local cell phone tower. Those rely on direct line of sight.
Like if there's a building in the way, you lose signal.
Exactly. If a mountain is between you and an FM tower, the signal is blocked. But shortwave signals operate on a completely different physical principle called skywave propagation.
Skywave propagation.
Instead of shooting the signal horizontally across the ground, these massive 250 kilowatt transmitters fire the radio waves up into the sky.
They shoot it into the atmosphere.
Specifically, they bounce it off the Earth's ionosphere.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the ionosphere acts like a giant, like an invisible mirror suspended in the upper atmosphere. So the signal goes up, hits this atmospheric mirror, and bounces back down to Earth.
That is crazy.
By doing this, the signal literally leaps over borders, mountain ranges, and local internet kill switches.
And what blows my mind from the, there's a slide in the source deck, the 4.7 billion population footprint slide, the scale of that bounce is insane.
It really is.
A single hop from a transmitter in Chagos covers a 3,000 to 5,000 kilometer radius. That one transmission front showers down on South Asia, Southeast Asia, East Africa, and the Middle East simultaneously.
Be massive.
The addressable footprint is roughly 3 billion people. But I have to be honest, I am stuck on a practical problem here.
Okay, what is it?
Bouncing radio waves off the sky sounds incredibly old school. Like, legacy AM shortwave is notorious for being terrible.
Right, yeah.
It is full of static, it fades in and out with the weather, and honestly, it sounds like you are listening to someone talking through a tin can underwater. Why would a modern engineering white paper suggest going backwards to analog radio to build the future of news?
So the authors of the white paper actually anticipate that exact skepticism. The critical distinction they make is between the crackly analog shortwave of the 20th century and the technology proposed here, what is called DRM.
DRM, like digital rights management.
I know. In this context, it stands for Digital Radio Mondiale.
Oh, okay.
DRM is a modern digital standard. It takes that massive continent-spanning reach of shortwave and upgrades it into a digitally resilient pipeline.
So it sounds better.
Way better. It provides near FM quality sound, and more importantly, it uses advanced mathematical error correction to, like, virtually eliminate the static and fading.
That makes sense. And the hardware is more efficient now, too, right? Because the slide mentions a 40% to 60% power reduction compared to the old analog transmitters that, like, the BBC or Voice of America used to run.
Absolutely. The power efficiency is a major factor. Mm-hmm. But the truly subversive element of DRM is how it handles data.
Okay, how so?
It creates a narrowband digital data pipeline. We're talking about operating on tiny 96 to 100 kilohertz channels. Because it is digital, it isn't just sending a raw audio recording, it multicasts.
Multitasks, meaning it sends more than one thing at a time.
Exactly. Alongside the high-quality audio stream, the DRM signal is transmitting rich, encrypted text and metadata.
Wait, so it is squeezing an audio feed and a text feed into the exact same invisible beam.
Yes.
It's almost like sending a letter to someone, but the envelope itself is made of scrolling digital text that updates in real time.
That is a brilliant way to visualize it. The text feature is called Journalin, which provides scrolling news updates directly to a receiver screen.
Very cool.
It also supports native emergency warning features. And because this is all broadcast from the middle of the ocean via the ionosphere, that combination of voice and text data is completely invisible to local internet sensors.
They literally can't block it.
Right. They cannot block it without physically confiscating every radio in the country.
That is an incredibly elegant solution for getting raw, uncensorable news into a heavily restricted area. But if we shift hats for a second and look at this from a business perspective, I see a glaring fatal flaw.
The monetization piece.
Yeah. If you are trying to run an independent media network, you need revenue. And if your signal is bouncing off the sky and hitting 3 billion people from India to Kenya all at once, you cannot sell a local advertisement for a neighborhood pizza shop in Mumbai to the entire continent of Africa.
Exactly. It doesn't work.
If the broadcast is that massive, how do you actually monetize the local neighborhood? It sounds like a commercial nightmare.
It is. And that historical inability to localize revenue is precisely why pure shortwave hasn't dominated the modern commercial media landscape. It offers unmatched reach, but zero neighborhood monetization.
Right.
But that is where the genius of Project OmniReach comes in. The blueprint introduces a hybrid technology stack to solve this, which they outline as layer 2 and layer 3.
Okay, so layer 1 is the big Chagos antenna.
Right. If the giant antenna is the macro level origin point, the next layers provide the micro level localization.
I want to dig into layer 2 because that involves integrating low Earth orbit satellites, and the white paper specifically names Starlink.
Right. The satellite layer.
Now, I am confused here. If we have a constellation of Starlink satellites hovering over the planet, why bother building giant radio towers on remote islands at all? Doesn't satellite internet completely solve the distribution problem on its own?
It's a fair question, and the blog post by William Pohl addresses that exact assumption. The critical thing to understand is that the satellite network is not the consumer endpoint in this architecture.
Oh, it's not?
No. Project OmniReach is not designed to put a Starlink dish on the roof of every listener. If you put a satellite dish on a house in a heavily censored authoritarian country, a government drone can spot it almost immediately.
Well, that makes total sense. You'd be a target.
Exactly. It subjects the listener to local regulatory friction, high hardware costs, and a monthly subscription. That defeats the entire mission of free, anonymous, uncensorable access.
So the satellite is just the hidden spine, basically. It is moving the data across the ocean, but it isn't delivering it directly to the citizen.
Precisely. The LEO satellites provide low-latency, high-capacity data streams, specifically radio over IP, to bridge the vast geographic gaps.
I see.
The satellite beams the pristine, uncensorable global news stream securely down to Layer 3, which the white paper calls the micro-hubs, or local head-ins.
Now we are getting to the mechanism that actually talks to the people. These micro-hubs, they're described as local VHF transmitters broadcasting on band 2 or 3. We are talking about very low power here, right?
Very low. Just 100 watts to 2 kilowatts.
Which only covers a local radius of maybe 10 to 50 kilometers, basically the size of a single city or a large district.
Yeah, these micro-hubs operate essentially as local edge servers. You have the global feed coming down from the secure satellite connection, and you feed it into a small local radio mast that blankets just that specific neighborhood.
And this solves the pizza shop problem. This is the revenue engine.
Exactly.
Let's break down how this actually works, because the white paper mentions the local hub injects programmatic hyperlocal inserts into the stream. How does a local antenna alter a global radio feed?
Okay, think of the global digital feed coming down from the satellite as a high-speed freight train. The local hub acts as a switching station.
Okay, switching station.
It takes that train, uncouples a few empty cars, and packs them with local text data, like a hyperlocal advertisement, a village-specific weather strap, or a regional emergency alert.
Wow.
The computer at the micro hub physically stitches this local data into the blank spaces of the digital radio wave just milliseconds before broadcasting it over the city.
So if you are driving your car within that 50-kilometer radius in Mumbai, you are hearing the exact same global news anchor as someone in Kenya, but the scrolling text on your dashboard and maybe the commercial audio breaks are completely customized to your specific street.
Yes.
It makes this giant, blunt instrument of global radio and evolves it into a granular, interactive medium capable of hyperlocal programmatic advertising.
That is wild. It really is. The architecture creates thousands of modular, profitable revenue islands.
Revenue islands. I love that term.
The white paper outlines an interesting contrast here. A normal digital platform like social media is brilliant at targeting ads, but structurally fragile. A traditional broadcast network is incredibly robust, but terrible at targeting ads.
And so this hybrid model merges the two.
Exactly. You use global skywave or satellite for the unbreakable mass distribution, and local VHF hubs for the micro-market monetization.
Okay, we have to talk about the price tag, though. Building giant antennas on islands, leasing satellite bandwidth, and erecting thousands of local transmission masts sounds like a multi-billion dollar endeavor.
You'd think so.
Like, when you hear global infrastructure project, you assume it requires the GDP of a small nation. How is this remotely economically viable?
The deployment economics and what the documents call infrastructure telemetry might be the most surprising revelation in this deep dive. Let's look at the actual costs to build a master hub in Chagos.
All right, let's do the math.
We need to distinguish between CapEx, the capital expense of physically building the site, and OpEx, the ongoing operational expense of keeping the lights on.
Okay, lay the numbers on me. What's the CapEx?
To build the site, you need a 250-kilowatt DRM transmitter and a massive curtain array antenna.
Real quick, what is a curtain array? Are we talking about like a standard metal radio pole?
Not at all. Imagine a massive net of heavy cables and wires, sometimes the size of a football field, strung vertically between two giant support towers.
Oh, wow.
It is designed specifically to catch and direct the radio waves upward at a precise angle to hit that atmospheric mirror we talked about.
Got it. So a massive wire trampoline for radio waves.
Exactly. The cost for that transmitter, the curtain array, and hardening the site against the elements is estimated at a shockingly low $5 to $8 million.
Wait, really? Just $8 million.
Yeah. Furthermore, you cannot rely on a local power grid on a remote island, so they factor in an additional $5.6 million for complete energy independence.
Okay, what does that buy?
That buys a 2.8 megawatt solar array, industrial battery storage, and microgrid controllers. So your total capital expense to build a sovereign broadcasting fortress is roughly $15 million maximum.
$15 million, that's nothing in tech terms, but that is just the cost of building it. What about running it?
The operational expense is almost entirely the cost of electricity. If you run the transmitter 18 hours a day, the documents estimate it costs about $1 million a year.
Okay, let me try to put this into perspective with an analogy, because I think I'm getting why this is so cheap at scale. If you run a modern digital streaming platform or a major news website, every single time a new person clicks your article or hits play on a video, it costs you a tiny bit more money.
Yep, server load.
You are paying Amazon Web Services or a content delivery network for that specific data transfer. It is literally like having to hire a bicycle courier for every single subscriber. As your audience grows, your server bills skyrocket.
Right, that's the linear cost of digital scaling.
Exactly. But wide area broadcast is completely different. It is like building a lighthouse. The physical cost of building the lighthouse and the electricity to keep the bulb burning is a fixed price.
A completely flat cost.
It doesn't cost the lighthouse keeper a single penny more if one ship looks at the light, or if 100,000 ships look at the light.
That analogy perfectly illustrates what the slide deck defines as the customer acquisition asymptote. Because broadcasting is fundamentally a one-to-many medium, your cost per listener scales logarithmically, not linearly.
The chart on this in the source material is fascinating. If you have 100,000 listeners, your cost breaks down to about $10 per listener. But as that audience scales up to 1 million, it drops to $1.
Yeah, the math is staggering.
At 10 million listeners, you are paying 10 cents. And when you hit that mass market threshold of 100 million plus people under the beam, the marginal cost to deliver data to a new user drops to a fraction of a single cent. It practically approaches zero.
Once the master hubs are constructed, every extra listener is essentially free in terms of distribution costs. William Pohl's blog features an AI analysis that actually crunched the numbers for deploying a complete network.
Oh, I saw that.
Yeah, a starter network comprising six master hubs globally and a large 1,000 local micro headends prices out at about $122 million. If you want an aggressive, total global footprint, 8 master hubs and 10,000 local headends, the estimate is $460 million.
So basically, the price of a mid-tier Silicon Valley startup that makes like an app for walking your dog, and instead you are buying a continent-wide, uncensorable news network. $500 million is massive for an individual, obviously, but in the realm of corporate tech or nation-state budgets, it's a rounding error.
The author points out that $460 million is the equivalent of a single major urban real estate development in New York or London. It makes sovereign media independence entirely feasible for a well-funded entity to just purchase outright.
But this brings up a massive practical hurdle. We have the money, sure, and the technology clearly works. But if I look around my house, I don't own a shortwave radio. None of my friends own one. The infrastructure sounds amazing, but how do 3 billion people actually tune in to a DRM signal?
Right, the receiver problem. The documents feature a strategic callout specifically addressing this ecosystem. They are not targeting the old wooden radio gathering dust in a garage.
Okay, so what's the target?
The primary target for Project OmniReach is the connected automotive dashboard. According to the sources, India has already undergone a massive DRM rollout pushed by All India Radio. As of 2026, there are over 13 million DRM-enabled cars already on the road there.
13 million cars. Why cars specifically?
Because a modern car is the perfect receiver. It has a high-quality antenna built into the frame, it has a captive audience, and most importantly, it has a digital dashboard screen ready to display that scrolling journal and text data.
Of course.
The white paper calculates that capturing just 10% of that existing automotive market in India creates an addressable audience larger than most European nations. And for people walking around, the gap is bridged by incredibly cheap smartphone SDR chips.
SDR meaning software-defined radio.
Correct. The processing power required to decode a DRM signal is so low today that a basic $20 USB dongle plugged into a smartphone can turn it into a high-fidelity digital shortwave receiver. The hardware barrier to entry is basically vanishing.
So the economics are sound, the physics are proven, and the receivers are literally rolling off assembly lines, which means we have to address the elephant in the room. The messy reality of international politics.
Yep, the geopolitics.
You can't just drop a massive antenna on an island without talking to governments. The sources dive deep into the geopolitical friction of actually pulling this off.
The geopolitical sandbox section of the white paper is critical because, obviously, this project does not exist in a vacuum. The analysis of the Chagos Islands is a perfect example of this reality check.
How so?
Well, the physics make it an ideal location, but the politics are incredibly volatile. According to the sources, in 2025 and 2026, the UK initiated the process of transferring sovereignty of the Chagos Archipelago over to Mauritius.
Right.
Meanwhile, the United States still retains a 99-year military lease on Diego Garcia, which is the primary island for any potential hub.
The The source is actually, quote, former U.S. President Donald Trump weighing in on this transfer. He called the handover great stupidity. And the strategic fear highlighted in the documents is that Mauritius holds significant national debts, which could open the door to Chinese influence over the archipelago.
Exactly.
It clearly illustrates that securing land for a civilian broadcasting fortress on an island undergoing a disputed sovereignty transfer while hosting a highly sensitive military base is just a geopolitical minefield. You run the risk of severely clashing with military priorities.
The leverage is intense. If an authoritarian-leaning state gains influence over the host nation, the uncensorable nature of your broadcast is suddenly under threat from the ground up.
Right.
And even if you navigate the land lease, you cannot just plug in a 250-kilowatt transmitter and start blasting radio waves across the planet.
Right. There are international spectrum laws. You can't just hijack the airwaves.
Exactly. The white paper outlines the mandatory compliance required by the ITU, the International Telecommunication Union. You have to navigate the High Frequency Coordination Conference, or HFCC.
That sounds complicated.
It is. Shortwave spectrum is a shared global resource, and it is carefully coordinated by season to prevent different countries from interfering with each other's broadcasts. You must register your exact frequencies and broadcast times in the Master International Frequency Register.
But wait, if the spectrum is that heavily guarded by an international body, how does Project OmniReach propose getting around the regulatory red tape? I mean, authoritarian nations on the ITU board would surely try to block a network designed to bypass their censorship.
Oh, absolutely. The strategy mapped out in the engineering documents is essentially a regulatory Trojan horse.
A Trojan horse.
Yeah. The proposal suggests framing the deployment not as a disruptive, uncensorable media empire, but strictly as a crucial regional public good. The blueprint leans heavily on the EWF, the emergency warning feature, built into the DRM signal.
Ah, so they pitch it as a disaster relief tool.
Exactly. Under the 2024 radio regulations, they pitch the massive transmitters as maritime safety backups, disaster resilience networks, and anti-blackout infrastructure designed to bridge the digital divide.
That is so smart.
By leading with emergency utility, the project is significantly more likely to secure host nation approvals and bilateral backing. It makes it politically very difficult for an opposing nation to argue against a system branded as a humanitarian safety net.
It is a brilliantly pragmatic strategy. So despite the complex licensing and the massive political hurdles, the underlying technological and economic proposition of Project OmniReach remains dangerously viable.
Synthesizing all of this, what the AI analysis in William Pohl's blog captures so well is the core paradigm shift this technology represents.
Yeah.
For the last two decades, the internet has convinced the entire media industry that all future communication fundamentally had to be one-to-one. It convinced us that individually routed streaming was the only evolutionary path forward, regardless of the staggering costs and the inherent fragility of relying on third-party servers.
We just accepted the rented infrastructure as permanent.
But this blueprint proves that the most efficient way to reach billions of people simultaneously is still a transmitter and an antenna. It suggests the true future of resilient, uncensorable information might not be one-to-one at all.
Right.
It might actually be one-to-many at the core, utilizing the physics of the ionosphere for massive scale, combined with many-to-local at the edge, using micro-hubs for revenue generation.
To you, our listener who sent this in, you brought us a blueprint that fuses the absolute oldest magic of broadcasting bouncing invisible waves off the sky with the newest magic of digital data insertion and IP satellite distribution. It completely flips how we're supposed to think about digital infrastructure.
Connecting this to the bigger picture, I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over.
Let's hear it.
If a global, uncensorable, highly profitable information network can be built for roughly $500 million, which is less than the cost of a single modern AI data center, the question is no longer whether this technology will be built. The real question is, who will realize they can become the new landlords of the airwaves first? Will it be a sovereign nation, a tech billionaire looking for unprecedented leverage, or an entirely new kind of global media monopoly?
Wow. It certainly makes you wonder who is currently holding the keys to the locks on your digital house. Thank you to our listener for sharing this incredibly thought-provoking deep dive into your sources. We encourage you to keep questioning the infrastructure you rely on every single day and never forget who actually owns the pipes. Until next time.